Hello, this is Hillel Techtan in the second of the critique podcast on the political economy of the present time. The first one was on austerity. This time I'm going to discuss the crisis as at the present time. To do that, I have first to give a summary of how I think the crisis arose in the first place. As I understand it, after 1979 or the late 70s, with the era of Reagan and Thatcher, the bourgeoisie effectively decided to switch to finance capital. That's to say, what it did was, in certain countries, to deindustrialize and, where possible, send industry to other countries like China. Whatever they did, they downgraded the relative importance of industry and promoted finance. Finance capital came to be dominant once again within the economy, once again because it had been such before the Second World War. The result was that money was subtracted from the rest of the economy and found itself in banks or in various kinds of finance houses. They evolved the so-called shadow banking system together with the banking system. It meant that industry was subordinated to the ever pressing demands of finance capital. What it did and what it meant was that finance capital built up huge sums which it could reinvest in itself or wherever else. And that was the problem. After a period of time, there was effectively too much money, particularly, of course, in the United States, to find an area of investment such that they got the kind of profit that they were looking for. That led to various bubbles, among which was the Southeast Asian bubble. There was the long-term capital management bubble, and there was the dot-com bubble, which ended that particular period, as it were, from the late 70s down to the year 2000. March 2000, the stock exchanges turned down. Now, the subsequent period might well have been the beginning of the downturn which we are living in. Because there was a downturn, but it turned up somewhat, not fantastic, but it turned up somewhat, partly as a result of 9/11, but much more because of the war on Iraq, which required a sufficient investment to assist the economy to revive somewhat. What we now had by 2005, 6, 7 was an economy, particularly in America and Britain, where there was a huge shift to things such as credit default swaps, which went up from something like 1 trillion in value to something like 63 trillion in value. The same thing applied to various other derivatives. The total level of derivatives went up to something like 670 trillion by 2008. It was obvious that this would have to crash. Because after all, where was the money going to go to? If it wasn't going to go into industry, where would it go into? Well, as I said, there were a series of crashes. One other area where it could invest was itself, which is what happened. It effectively became cannibalist. It went into what Marx would call the unproductive sector. It went into loans for housing. It went into commercial real estate. And it went into simple derivatives themselves. Now that kind of what looked like a virtuous circle obviously couldn't last. It had to explode. Because it was based on nothing in the end. But of course it would explode, and one would expect it to explode, when people took shortcuts or even did things which were not legal, which is what actually happened. Once that happened, the whole thing began to topple. And that is where we are. That's to say, there is not much that has changed. We still have this huge surplus of money, which I've quoted many times over, like the roughly $27 trillion held under administration by one bank, the Bank of New York Mellon, or the something like $21 trillion so apparently held offshore in various havens as a means of avoiding or evading tax. When we start to think of these huge sums, we have to ask, what is going to happen? What's going to happen to them? After all, if they simply hold them in havens, and they simply hold them in a bank in which they actually have to pay for it, that's to say the owners of the money have to pay rather than then receiving interest, then they are losing the money itself. So of course, they want to find a way out of that. But, and this is the crucial point, they don't want to invest. They don't want to go into industry. So, what is going to happen? And that is the issue. It's not at all clear what can happen. All we can see is that there's a deadlock, because after all, the vast amounts of money, freed as it were, of a context, freed of industry, came about as a direct decision to move out of industry. The logic would, of course, be that if they wanted to preserve the money, they would have to find a way of going back into the productive sector, back into industry. But that doesn't seem to be on the cards, although it hangs in the air. We'll come back to that. So in the meantime, what we have is these various funds looking for somewhere to invest. And they may go into hedge funds, which is simply a capitalist form, really, or they may simply be held in banks, or they can speculate on the stock exchange. And when we come to that, we can see the stock exchange has been going up and down. And commentators have made this exact point, that but you have this huge wall of investment, potential investment rather, which is looking to put its money somewhere, and it's been holding back. When it looked like there was an opportunity to put it into the stock exchange and make money, money poured into it. And we may expect that to happen again and again. Equally, you can expect them to withdraw money, and that's precisely what has happened in the last 2 weeks, that the various indexes, like the Dow Jones and the British FTSE, have gone up and have gone back down, though not the whole way so far. And in the United States, the Dow Jones has remained at its highest level ever. Of course, in fact, taking account of inflation, is not the highest level ever. However, what we see is this kind of gyration reflecting the huge amounts of money which need somewhere to go. So, it's not going away, in fact. And in contrast, what we see is a world economy which is bumping along the bottom. At one point it was thought that the third world economies would grow at a rapid pace and help to pull the rest of the world out of the mire. In fact, that has not only not happened, but these economies are going down themselves. One now reads article after article about how Brazil is in trouble. Its rate of growth is very low, around 1% and so forth. Russia, of course, has suffered from an outflow of capital. And in any case, it's hard to imagine much happening in Russia, given the fact they still haven't tried, in fact, or got anywhere with an attempt to change the Rust Belt, which is most of their economy. They remain dependent on oil and raw materials, exports. So the one hope that the world had before, that's to say, economists in the City of London and New York or wherever had before, was that China would pull the world out. But in fact, China has turned down. Now, that China would turn down was surely obvious, even if much of the left seemed to be completely oblivious to this. I remember having a debate precisely around this question some years ago. Well, China has turned down for the obvious reason that its growth was dependent effectively on free labor. That's to say, labor free of attachment to various forms of industry. In this instance, I'm using free labor in a completely different sense from the way it normally is used, that that's to say, non-slave labor, non-attached labor, whatever. I'm using it in the sense that it's labor, in the case of China, which has come from the villages, which has limited skills, is free of any attachments, not controls, but attachments, and has relatively low skill. The point about that is that if you have a labor force of that kind, it's easy to direct it from one point to another. And it's easy to educate it, to develop it further, and use it to expand your industrial development. Because you can educate them on the job, you can move them from one town to another. The rate of growth, therefore, can be very high. That's what happened in Russia, though, of course, in Russia, it took on a somewhat different form. Nonetheless, that is what happened in Russia, the fact that there was this control over labor, and particularly over surplus labor, that's to say, the amount that was extracted from the labor of the people who were working above their wages and other costs. The fact that the regime then had control over the surplus labor and could reinvest it fairly easily in points that would lead to a high rate of growth because they were the shortage areas and so forth, was what allowed them to have a very high rate of growth. But that period is necessarily limited. And in the case of China, that has happened. It's true that there are still millions, perhaps half the population, maybe less, on the in agriculture. But the relative shortage of labor today has allowed rising wages, rising real incomes, rising wages, and consequently a lower surplus product. Now, from the point of view of the majority in China, there can be no question that this is a step forward. They are better off. Nonetheless, from the point of view of growth, we have to say it would have to come down. The second reason one could talk of it necessarily coming down is that it wasn't very clear, given the nature of the economy, given what I've just been describing, where the investments were going to go. And in fact, like in Russia, like in the former Soviet Union, The Chinese invested substantially in the infrastructure. Unfortunately, a considerable part of that infrastructure was in roads, blocks of apartments, flats, and so forth, in areas where nobody went. So that large part, or a considerable part, maybe not a fantastically large part, but a considerable part was of that surplus product was effectively wasted in these investments. It may be that's not totally wasted, maybe that they can be pressed into use and so forth. And over time they will be used. However, there is a limit to this kind of investment, clearly. And of course, one also has to say that one asks whether one can count such investment as investment, whether it should be counted in the gross national product and so forth, if in fact it cannot be used. However, that's the second point. This is we're talking about the second point as to why it would have to go down. The third aspect is the actual figures for growth, the Chinese figures, are often questioned. That's to say, the actual rate of growth, even when it was high, was probably somewhat lower than it appeared. However, the Chinese themselves are saying the rate of growth has gone down and will go down. And given that the rate of growth, in fact, is questioned, the figure is questioned, one has to say that it's highly unlikely that China could pull the world out of its downturn. But this is even more true, or as it were, it is still more obvious that this would happen if the world went into a downturn and their imports from China would go down. Because to a considerable extent, as we all know, the Chinese high rate of growth was dependent on exports, particularly to Europe and the United States. And since Europe is effectively in a considerable downturn, and American growth is relatively stagnant, consequently, imports from China are well down. A fact which, of course, everybody knows. But the result is that the Chinese rate of growth would necessarily go down, even without what I've just mentioned. In fact, the Chinese economy may well be in trouble. So far from actually assisting the world to grow, it may act as a drag on it. We don't know. We don't know enough as to how the Chinese bureaucracy will in fact act. And it has to be said that insofar as they have the levers of state control, they are in a better position than in the West, where one simply sees stagnation all round, that both the private sector and the public sector stagnate. And there appears to be little control. We'll go back to that. But I'm contrasting that with China and saying that the Chinese may, I don't know, they may have more control and they may be able to prevent what would amount to a very difficult period in the history of growth of China from now onwards. So, where are we today? We are in a position which is effectively no better than it was before 2007. And in fact, with the exception of the rescue of the banking sector, it is no better off all around. Even the banking sector, as the newspapers constantly report, remains in trouble, particularly in Europe. America apparently has, to a large extent, cleaned up its act. Various smaller banks have gone bankrupt, have merged. Big banks have been assisted to continue. And because the United States did grow as opposed to have negative growth, as in Europe and in Britain, banks were also assisted. But it remains the case that in Europe banks remain in trouble. That's to say, they need much more money in order to deal with the bad debts that they hold on their books, and they need a higher ratio of assets, let's say, cash-type assets in relation to their total loans, in order to ensure that they will not be in trouble. So, the banking sector remains, therefore, a source of trouble, particularly in Europe, and it remains true in Britain too. Now, the question then is, where are we going to go here? The first thing that is obvious is that in a crisis, the different poles pull apart. And we've been watching this. We've seen by finance and industry, which were already, as it were, at one level pulling apart, pulled apart still further. We've seen the way protectionism is now spreading and in fact is intensifying. So far, protectionism is relatively low compared to the Great Depression. Nonetheless, it's certainly hotting up. And of course, there's been this fight between China and Europe over solar panels, somewhat ridiculous, looked at, as it were, from afar. But it is reflecting the discontent at competition with the European producers. Clearly, you are not going to get the big German car manufacturers asking for protection. They are world beaters anyway, and they are not going to ask for it. The big firms in general don't need it, except in certain cases. If they need it, they will find ways of expressing themselves in due course. However, at the present time, it is primarily the lower section of the bourgeoisie. What might have been called the petty bourgeoisie, except they are wealthier than the petty bourgeoisie. They have firms. The number of people working with them isn't very great, maybe 10. There may be bigger firms with considerably more. But nonetheless, these firms are often in debt. They work for the really big firms, usually. And the large firms try, of course, to get their supplies at the lowest possible price. And they will turn to suppliers outside their own immediate sphere, outside a particular country, and so forth. So, you would expect this lower section of the bourgeoisie, or petty bourgeoisie, to be highly discontented and to ask for more protection. Or protection. Which is what is happening. And their grievances, of course, would not only express themselves in terms of direct protection, but in a series of other political demands. In Britain, most particularly, it is that Britain leave the European Union. If it does that, of course, it can then introduce a series of protectionist forms in order to build up industry. That is the way they would look at it, and that is the way things are going. The tremendous demand which is being expressed in Britain for dealing with the EU or for having a referendum on the question of the EU or for actually leaving the EU completely expresses above all this group's interest. It's not that there isn't similar interest groups in other countries. Clearly they are. And they will similarly demand various forms of protection. And that is what is tending to happen, of course. One would expect it to go even further. as the standard of living declines, as this section of the bourgeoisie finds itself forced downwards, and of course you'd expect them to make common cause with a section of the workers in asking for this kind of protection, which is of course what is happening. So what we are seeing is forms of disintegration as opposed to integration, which had taken place in the period of global expansion. It's not a coincidence that various parts of countries, like in Britain, want to declare themselves independent, or that in Spain, Catalonia wants to declare itself independent as a richer area within a poorer area which it has to subsidize. One may expect this to extend itself. Now, briefly, I'd like to just turn to this question of how stable in this overall climate of disintegration one might be able to say the European Union is. Rather interestingly, today, Monday, 10th of June, Wolfgang Munchau in the Financial Times takes up the cry of the IMF that the attitude of the European Union or the Eurozone bureaucrats towards Greece was wrong 3 years ago when they began applying pressure to it. Well, it clearly was, not just from the angle that what they were doing was brutal and cruel, but it didn't have a hope in hell of working. And Munchau points out that right down to the present day, the settlement changed as it has, having been through a whole series of forms, still can't work and obviously can't work and will never work. That's undoubtedly true. Now that is a reflection of what's happening within the EU itself or the Eurozone itself. It hasn't paid the Greeks to leave the European Union. And obviously, simply leaving the Union, the European Union, would mean that many of them would lose out because you'd have an immediate devaluation of the currency, and the imports which they previously held, previously made, would cost, in effect, a small fortune, so the standard of living could drop catastrophically. That is true. On the other hand, what he's really pointing out is that the pressure being applied to Greece, given that it simply continues, as it were, is such that at some point they may say enough is enough and just get out. Well, that's entirely possible. Point being that the Eurozone doesn't work, and they haven't introduced any measure to make it work in any kind of economic union of the kind which they've gone towards. It is obvious that some areas will be richer, some will be poorer. Some areas will import more from the richer areas, and the richer areas will export more to the poorer areas. You will consequently have an imbalance there, which will reflect itself in a series of economic data. Unless the richer areas are prepared to accept what any country accepts, as in the United States, that the center must in some way or other assist parts of its union, and the richer areas in effect subsidize the poorer areas, assist them, as it were, to become richer in themselves. Unless they do that, it simply cannot work. Now, of course, this is obvious, and people have been saying that for some time. Well, so far, there is no change, no movement in this direction. If there is no movement, it simply cannot hold. It's not simply that Germany will effectively find itself in trouble in relation to the rest of the EU, but of course France is already in conflict with Germany, and it's not just that you have a different philosophy in France as compared to Germany. There are real differences, there are real changes. So it's hard to see how the European Union can, Eurozone can actually hold together. It is, of course, possible that there'd be a change in the coming election. It's possible the Social Democrats will actually move to the left and take the viewpoint that I've just put forward. It's possible that there'll be a series of measures which will damp down the problems. However, at the present time, it doesn't look like it. We are therefore in for a long period, as it were, of instability within Europe. Given that Europe, in fact, has the larger population than the United States, that it is a highly developed part of the world, critical to the global economy, if this is the case, it's hard to see how much can change within the overall depression. However, it's not just Europe, in fact. As I just pointed out, there are problems in practically every country. Not excluding the United States, where in fact, although it has a positive rate of growth, when you consider the influx of young people into the labor force and add up the figures, what you find is that the number involved in terms of the GDP shows that the United States basically has no growth at all. It has growth precisely because more people are joining the labor force, more people may be working, but the percentage, of course, of the numbers who are working may be static or may even go down. However, the numbers entering the workforce continues to rise. Consequently, the GDP per person working, or in the labor force rather than working, can be static and is relatively static. At the same time, the reality, of course, is that the numbers of unemployed remains very high, and is almost certainly at least twice as high as the figure that is handed out. And you have a deadlock within Congress, which makes it hard to pump in enough money, or rather engage in projects which would actually work to raise the standard of living of all and which would lead to growth. And Obama talked to 77,000 bridges having to be repaired this year, and in his first term talked of having high-speed rail across America. That would have been part of something which would have meant growth, but of course that isn't happening and isn't likely to happen. So what instead you have is in fact something different. And I would like, therefore, to finish with a more general point, and that is this. We see a world which is in a depression. We see a world which the parts are disintegrating. We also see a world in which the bourgeoisie is fighting itself. The bourgeoisie has taken a number of different viewpoints. Some want austerity, some want growth. And there's a series of other viewpoints which are variations on that. We've seen the IMF talk about growth, and that almost certainly reflects the viewpoint in the United States, as opposed to the viewpoint in Germany or in Britain. It's not just governments here. We're talking really of sections of the bourgeoisie. So, they are divided. But they are more than divided. Because when one probes one or other side, they are not able to provide a coherent explanation of where they are and why they are. Generally, they produce a series of propaganda statements, much of which is untrue, much of which simply doesn't apply. That's most particularly true of the Conservative government in Britain, where its whole emphasis on the need to save money, the need to reduce the deficit, is simply wrong. And Krugman is absolutely right that it's the economics of the madhouse. There's no truth to what they're actually saying, particularly when one thinks of the completely mad position where the Bank of England is buying government bonds and holds something like close to a third of British government bonds, meaning that the British debt is a third less than what it seems, which makes it wholly acceptable in numerical terms. That simple fact, which they never allow to be expressed, as it were, which shows how it's possible, in fact, to expand, leads one to conclude, of course, that there, of course, is another agenda. But we have talked about that under austerity. In fact, they want something else. What they want is a small public sector. They want to change the whole nature of the economy. That is definitely there, though it's not necessarily part of every person who supports their viewpoint. It is definitely there. So, what I'm saying, therefore, is what we have is a series of different viewpoints, that the overall result is a muddle. That whereas it is actually possible to get out of the present downturn, they will not do that. And they will not do that because ultimately it would lead to suicide. And that is another question. Thank you.